I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is October 27th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Vice Chair Wasilewicz.
Wasilewicz present.
Representative Heintzeman.
Heintzeman present.
Representative Acomb.
Acomb present.
Representative Ackland.
Ackland present.
Representative Becker.
Becker present.
Representative Becker Finn.
Becker Finn present.
Representative Ackland.
Present.
Representative Fisher. Representative Fisher. Representative Igo.
Igo present.
Representative Jordan.
Jordan present.
Representative Keeler.
Keeler present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Lippert present.
Representative Lewick.
Lewick present.
Representative Morrison.
Morrison present.
Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Thank you. Quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Quorum is present. Members, we had some background during the roll there, so if people could keep their microphones muted unless they're presenting, and if they can use the raise hand function seeking to be called on. Members, today we are going to be hearing updates from some of our agencies. The deer season in Minnesota is right around the corner, the firearms deer season. And when we met last, we said we were going to have a follow-up meeting for the DNR to give updates and to make sure that they are ready for the deer season with CWD precautions. Secondly, we'll be hearing from the DNR on the Emerald Ash Borer grants that have already gone out. And then finally, from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency on what was known as the climate resiliency grants are now local water grants. So we have allocated some time. We have an hour and a half. I want to make sure we have time for questions. First up, we have Dr. Kelly Straka from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Also, Dave Benke from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is available for questions about the dumpster program. So we have 15 minutes starting now. So about 10:20, we would open up for questions that would go for 15 minutes to 10:35. That's our rough timeline. So with that, Dr. Straka, welcome, and state your name and who you're with for the committee.
Good morning. Thank you very much. This is Kelly Straka. I am with the DNR. Can you guys hear me? Can you hear me okay?
You seem to be freezing up a little bit in mid-sentence, so try again.
Okay, can you hear me okay now? Yes, okay. And can you see my screen? I am sharing. I just want to make sure you can see it.
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Hopefully this will work okay. I wanted to take a second. I know we don't have much time here today. I did want to introduce myself. I am a veterinarian and the new wildlife section manager for the DNR. So I did want to thank you for having us here today for this update. Last month, you got the CWD update from Dr. Michelle Carstensen. She could not be with us today. So I do apologize. I am not only new, but I do not know nearly as much as she does about certainly where we are right now with CWD, but I am getting up to speed. So if there are any questions I can't answer, which I do anticipate there will be, I certainly will make sure that we follow up with you and get the information that you need. All of that okay, or am I breaking up still?
So Dr. Straka, if you could turn off your video and go from the screen, I think that would help. So
Sure, absolutely. Let me do that for you. Okay, how's that working?
Better.
Great. Okay, I apologize for any technical issues. I will get right into it. But again, I am new to the agency. I'm excited to be here. I do have quite a background with CWD. Dr. Carstensen can't be with us today, but she certainly is a subject matter expert on this. So I apologize you have the B team today, but I will, in the interest of time, move forward with this. Are you seeing my second slide right now? Should be a map of Minnesota.
Yes.
Great. Perfect. Okay, so this is at the September 14th update. Nothing has changed on this, so I won't belabor it. But again, just a reminder of where we're going to be conducting CWD surveillance for 2021. Again, this is the same slide that you would have seen last month. We are expecting to do around 22,500 samples this year. That's quite an increase over last year, but obviously with COVID during 2020, we did see a decline in sampling. So again, our total anticipated costs of surveillance this year are going to be about $2 million. Again, this is just a close-up of where our stations are going to be located. We do have I know it gets confusing, but there are a few different ways that we're going to be running stations this year. We do have certainly our staff check stations, which I think most people are used to. We also have what we're calling the self-service. I think previously were called head boxes. That can get confusing because they're not always boxes, right? Sometimes they're barrels. So understanding that these are really useful, it's kind of like using an ATM, right? So not actually put a head in, hopefully a deer head, that is what they're designed to collect. But so now we're referring these as self-service sampling stations. So if you hear that language, it is again, what formerly was referred to as a head box. We also have the extraction sites, because obviously if hunters leave us heads in boxes or barrels, those heads still need to have the tissues collected. And so those will be centralized to extraction sites. We have one in every zone. So we will be actually collecting those heads from the barrels and boxes and extracting the tissues at sites within each zone. This is one of the changes I wanted to make sure that I pointed out as part of this update. So I know we talked to you guys in September about where our stations are going to be. We have, and there were some concerns, certainly about outside of that opening weekend, what if hunters up in some of these areas still want to get additional samples collected? And so certainly we have added, you can see on this map here, you'll see locations in Black Duck and Ten Strike. We are going to be offering self stations. So again, those kind of drive-through places where hunters can drop off heads for us. We've added two more. So we've added two and because they are closest to that CWD infected deer facility and carcass dump site. So those will be monitored 2 to 3 times a week by our local. We have any situation of heads overflowing at those. We certainly want to be timely with not only collecting collecting those heads from the box, we get those tissues collected and submitted for testing so that hunters get a rapid turnaround. Keep in mind, we still do have the appointments available that we talked about last month at DNR local wildlife offices for folks who want to go that route. We will have these self-service stations I talked about, that third kind of route for hunters, which I know is not on the slide, but it's where hunters can work directly with the diagnostic lab. Now that does come at a cost, and the turnaround times for hunters going directly to diagnostic labs honestly can be prohibitive for a lot of folks, right? It's several weeks out. And so what do you do with the carcass in that meantime? But so we do have the alternative addition now, the new addition within the last month of adding the Black Duck and Ten Strike locations for self-service sampling. Again, this is the website. The link is at the top of your screen. So we can keep that updated. So hunters can kind of have what we're detecting in terms of positives, broken down by gender, broken down by collection method, and certainly by year. So all of the information is at the website on your screen. Little reminder too, I know we'll hear a little bit more about the dumpster program, but we certainly do have 32 sites with dumpsters available this fall. We also have a number of landfills where hunters are encouraged to go to get rid of some of their carcasses. All that information is on our website as well. And so we can certainly help facilitate proper carcass disposal. One more change I did want to bring up for folks is that you would have seen this map, I think, been back in September. This currently is the map of where we have deer feeding and attracted bands in place. You can kind of see attractants. There has been a proposal, and I know this was talked about. You can see the last bullet point that was presented back in September, that there will likely be an expansion of deer feeding ban in Beltrami County and surrounding areas. That has been proposed to our commissioner's office. We did have a meeting about it this week. If that is accepted, it will not be in effect for this season. So if accepted, it would not go into effect until December 30th or 31st of this year. So again, we don't have any bans in around that Beltrami County facility for this deer season. But certainly, if accepted, we will be adding 8 counties, including Beltrami and immediately adjacent to that county, to the deer feeding ban. So that'll be a total of 16 counties under the deer feeding ban, again, if it's accepted. And again, that will not go into effect until after this deer season. All right, and this slide, well, just a reminder when we talk about co-management, because I do have an update on the co-management aspect of captive white-tailed deer farms, a reminder why we are here, but in the interest of time, I will spare you and not go through this slide too heavily, but here are a couple of the changes I wanted to bring up. So we have had some progress since our September 14th hearing with you last time. Additions are in red font. So what you will see in particular is that I know Dr. Carstensen talked about going on the joint inspections with the Board of Animal Health. We have a goal actions prior to the December 17th deadline. We in the DNR have added 12 additional staff to help with this effort. Some are going to be coming from wildlife. 6 of them are from our law enforcement group. We've added those 12 folks to really help facilitate some of those inspections. Previously, we had 2 people doing it, and it's hard, right? There's a number of these facilities across, and have 2 people try to tackle that many in a short period of time. We felt that it would be important to beef up that staff that are going to be helping with those inspections, and I know they've already. The next update I wanted to bring up is the attainment of core. Familiar with Core One. I have not actually worked with that database, but certainly that is going through our purchasing procedures right now so that the DNR will have a select group of staff and DNR will have access to that Core One database, can not only see the data, but enter some of the data as well. So that certainly will help facilitate some of the co-management aspects with the board. That was it for me. I know it's short. Certainly looking forward to the open question and answer session. And again, I apologize for any technical difficulties. Hopefully you heard me okay, and I'm excited to talk to you folks. So thanks for having me.
Members, any questions? Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Straka. Just wondering if you can give us an update on how communicating with hunters is going. You know, I can tell you specifically as a hunter near the Beltrami area, you know, other than following the DNR Twitter page and, you know, really carefully reading the manual, just wondering what other efforts, I know there've been maybe a couple meetings, but just wondering how that's going. Cause I have concerns that folks don't realize all the things that they need to do differently this year compared to the past, especially for these new areas. So if you could update us on how communicating all this to the public is going, that would be great.
Sure. Yeah, I can try. Thank you very much. Are you hearing me okay? We gotta love our Zoom world. Okay, yes. So a couple of updates that I can give you, and I certainly can follow up if I miss anything. And what I can tell you right now, I will certainly follow up with our big game program and make sure, you know, they can fill in any gaps. But you're right. You referenced a couple of the local meetings that were held. We did hold one in Bemidji as well as one in Kellyer. I did the Bemidji one was virtual. I participated virtually as well as I think they were in person too, but I attended that virtually. The Kellyer one was in person. those meetings, we had Dr. Barb Keller came and talked a lot about what to expect in that area, what hunters can expect. The Board of Animal Health was there too. Dr. Linda Glazier was there, and she gave a great talk too about what the board is doing in terms of responding to the captive facility that was infected. And so again, Barb gave that information through those two venues. I don't know how many people were at the Bemidji meeting. I know the Kellyer meeting that I did attend, I think we had around 30 or so. It was what I would say is a smaller group, right? But it was they were very engaged. So the hunters that were there, are the questions that were on all the way until I think it was 9 o'clock. Really good questions, a lot of engagement from that group. I also know there's been outreach with our Deer Advisory Committee. I did sit in on part of that meeting, and the Deer Advisory Committee is for those that don't know, made up of a number of different groups around the state. And so I know there's been a lot of outreach that way. There is a webinar this afternoon. I think it's from noon to one, talking about CWD and what are the updates that hunters can expect. So I'm not sure how many people enrolled for that, but I can certainly get you that information, and that webinar is in this afternoon. As for that, I know there's a number of other things that are being planned, but I can get you a full list of that are focused on that hunter outreach, if that's going to be helpful. Other than that, those are the top things that are on the top of my mind.
Representative. Quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specifically, I'm wondering too, it feels like, you know, even if we're communicating that folks need to get tested, what can deer hunters expect as far as the timeline for the wait in between? And I know we asked this last time, but I think this part is really important, because I can tell you that, you know, the weather isn't necessarily going to be the right weather so that we can have those, you know, harvested deer hanging for long amounts of time, and now they're going to be headless. So the way to keep those animals before they're butchered. You know, I know for our family, it was like calling around to see who's got fridge space. Yeah. If you could talk a little bit just about the timeline and what hunters should expect so that they can be planning ahead, because we've got less than 2 weeks to get those details figured out.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. And I think we've had a little conversation, Representative, about this as well. And I, you know, as a hunter myself, I've been in the same boat. And certainly I went through this when I lived in Missouri. And no matter what the weather is in Missouri, I can promise you, it is never good enough to hang your deer out. So what we have talked about in terms of communicating with hunters how to best handle this is knowing that we're going to be getting those samples sent out to the diagnostic lab as quick as we can, you know, and that's a big part of running these extraction sites. We'll be sending those samples out to the lab. I think our first shipment is planned for Monday or Tuesday, right after opener. But keep in mind that the lab, their turnaround times, I think, are still about a week, you know, and so we are looking at getting results posted as soon as we can, but it's going to be depending on how fast those diagnostic labs, I mean, that really can be the crunch in terms of time. So what we've been talking to hunters about and the messaging that we're putting out is really making sure people have a plan. You're absolutely right when it's like, you know, you almost feel like you have to scramble. Where do you put these carcasses? How do you hold them? You know, we make the recommendations that hunters quarter carcasses when they can. You know, I personally will quarter my carcass. I'll take meat off the thorax and the abdomen and keep it in coolers. I realize that it is definitely a change for hunters. This can be almost an insurmountable change for some hunters. But making sure that you make a plan. I would love to tell people that we'll have results for you back in a week, but the reality is that we're a little bit at the mercy of the labs and how fast they can operate. And so tell people, plan for longer, you know, if you can, plan for longer. I realize it's hard, I do, but we do recommend not to consume, obviously, anything until you've got those test results. So that's kind of the recommendation that's out there right now. I do realize that it is a change for a lot of folks, but we do have 2 weeks to kind of plan on what are you going to do with your meat. So I hope that helps. If there's anything else I missed, obviously I'll send you guys any other information that our staff have.
Representative Becker Finn, were you done?
Nope, that's all, Mr. Chair. I guess we'll probably be butchering over Thanksgiving break is what I'm hearing. So, but thank you, Dr. Straka.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that question, Representative Becker Finn. So my one of my family members actually harvested a deer this past weekend, and I'm looking at the status online and it said it's pending. And so, you know, that was one of the questions that I was going to ask. So appreciate that. And then Dr. Straka, you know, just being on the website right now, I see that, you know, we have the CWD test results from July 1st all the way to present. My question is, how long do we keep track of these results? Are we keeping it quarterly or how long?
Dr. Straka.
That's a great question. That's a great question, Representative Lee. Thank you very much for asking that. So just so I'm clear, when you mean how long we're keeping track of all the results, do you mean internally, or how long do we keep those out publicly? I just want to make sure I understand.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Straka, publicly on the website.
Dr. Straka.
This is helpful. Thank you, Chair. I didn't realize I should wait until you said my name. I apologize. I think we should be able to, you should publicly be able to access our archives, and I can double check on that for you. Again, the states that I've worked in, you can go back longer time. Maybe we can't Minnesota. I can follow up on that for you and get a handle on exactly how far we can go. I can tell you internally, I mean, we'll be able to access all of our records from the beginning of our testing, and so hopefully I can make sure that I get that information for you. I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure right now how far back that goes publicly.
Last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Dr. Straka, I asked this because, you know, on the website of looking at the tag number for my family member, I see in two of the zones that's just north of where we were at, there's three positive. And so, you know, as a hunter or, you know, someone just looking at this, I would like to know how or when, you know, these positives were identified. Was it near, you know, the time that we have, you know, our deer harvested, or was it, you know, back in July or August? And so I think it will be helpful if you could provide us that information on how long or maybe even when these were identified, so that, you know, as a member of the public, we can have a peace of mind of what's going on with the CWD situation there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Straka, could you put up that slide with the positives from this year so we can see it? I think you had it up, but my glasses may need an extra power on them in order to read smaller text.
You know, Chair, and sure, absolutely. I will try to do that for you. The thing I'm not sure, to be honest, is I'm not sure if the slide that I have is going to be from this year, if that is from this year. Can you see my slides okay?
I can see the thank you. Any questions? Yep.
Great. So this should be, I have on my screen, I'm looking at the test results from each zone. So that is from 2010 to present. And so you can certainly see all of that, but this isn't going to be interactive. I can follow up on Representative Lee's question and see how far back, because I think we should be able to tell when those positives were detected. We should be able to tell that on the website. And so I can into that and get that information for you.
So my question is, the chart that you have on the right, what would be on the screens, right, where it says CWD sampling results for the surveillance zone, that is, and there are zero positives, zero suspects. Is that this year's archery, or is that just a sample site?
I would say right now, this is just a sample, because this slide, I'm not sure when they made the slide, you know, when they put this together. And so I wouldn't be confident saying that this is our current situation right now.
Do we have any positives from the archery season?
You know, I'm not sure that we do. I believe we've had, I'll have to look into that for you. I don't think that I have been notified of any since archery so far. If we have, it should be reflected on the website currently. I can look into that and make sure that we get that information for you.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Straka, for being here and providing us with this update. My question is, you touched on it briefly, but I'm just kind of wondering if you could update us on, you know, obviously there are ongoing unknowns and concerns about the public health implications of CWD. And I'm wondering if you could provide us an update on how you're coordinating with Dr. Peter Larson and his team at the U, how DNR and Board of Animal Health are working with them.
Dr. Straka.
Sure. No, thank you for that. Actually, the two public meetings that I referenced earlier that were held up in Bemidji and Kellyer, Dr. Larson and his group were there. So Dr. Mark Schwabenlander, who works out of that same group at the University of Minnesota, he gave a presentation along with Dr. Keller and Dr. Glazier, so the ones I talked about before. So they're certainly part of the conversation, have been part of the outreach with the hunters, have been in frequent communication with them. I do know that Michelle, the supervisor of our wildlife health program, she certainly works really closely with that MinPro group and talks with them regularly about their testing and their procedures. So I did have a chance to touch base with them. I have known them, several people in that group. I've known them throughout my career, and it's been great to be back home, which is, I'm from here. And so it's been great to be back home and be able to work with them again. And so I think the communications are pretty frequent. I know Dr. Thompson is on here right now on behalf of the board. And so maybe she can answer how the board is communicating with MinPro, but certainly I can say that our wildlife health program is in frequent communications with Dr. Larson and his group.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd love to hear from Board of Animal Health too, if you don't mind.
I think when we get to them, we'll go back to your question. So I know that Representative Eklund has been trying to raise his hand on the, and it's not working. And so if Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was my question, is how many positives had come out of the archery season. And so Dr. Straka, thank you for your presentation. If you get that answer back to us, I'd appreciate it.
Representative Heinzman, any questions?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. You've been having some technical difficulties, so I want to make sure your members, if they're having some trouble too, if they can get on. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep everybody in the loop on that.
One of the questions we had at the last meeting was on sampling. So I just wanted to go back to the plan currently is to only have sampling on the first weekend of what traditionally was the A and then the B season. Is that correct, Dr. Straka?
So we will be running throughout the entirety of the seasons through those self-service sampling stations. So what I talked about a little bit earlier on that slide is those outlets for hunters to be able to do that outside of just those weekends. So they will be able to use those self-service sampling stations. And all of that information is available not only on our website, but also in the printed Hunter Digest. I think it's pages 76 to 78, around there. Either way, we do have that. We do have opportunities for additional testing outside of those weekend windows. Does that answer your question, Chair Hansen?
Maybe I should have said staffed sampling. So there is staffed sampling for hunters who come in who may have not pulled lymph nodes before. There would be staff sampling the first weekend of the A and the B. Is that correct? At certain
yes,
sites, and then go ahead.
Yeah. We do have staffed check stations, and so those will be staffed with not only DNR staff, but we do have a number of students from colleges and universities across the state, as well as volunteers. And that's this week, is that we've been able to sign up a few volunteers. Either way, we will have that opportunity for our staff or trained students to collect those samples for hunters so they don't have to do it themselves.
And were there any staffed sampling sites during the youth deer hunt or the early antlerless hunt? Last weekend?
That's a great question. I don't know if hunters would have had to make an appointment for that. I'm not sure. I can look into that for you and make sure we get that information too. I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, it's past, but what a good way to get young hunters to be in the habit of the sampling. And then for the special CWD hunts in December, will those be staff sampling or will those be service centers?
Well, we will have the service centers open. The self-service stations. I don't know if there will be staff check stations available too, or if it'll just have to be through appointment with individual field offices. So I can see too, if we're going to be running those check stations as well.
If those are special hunts explicitly for CWD, it would be a good idea to have staff sampling at those hunts.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Hansen. I agree.
And then if Mr. Benke could come on from PCA about the dumpsters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Dave Benke from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Director of our Resource Management and Assistance Division. Update on the disposal from the dumpster locations. We've been working across the state with disposal facilities, landfills, as well as the waste energy facilities to make sure that we've got a place for these collected remains to go and be properly disposed of. In all the areas that we have worked on, we have those disposal options available. They're not only for the dumpsters then, they also then carry over to individuals using their normal disposal options, as well as taxidermists, meat processors, all, you know, making sure that we've got a place for that collected material to go. And so we're in good shape this year. I know a couple of years back we did lose a disposal facility late in the game, and we wanted to make sure that that didn't happen this year. And so having checked in with everyone the past couple of weeks, we're good to go. So that's just a quick update on the disposal end of things from the agency.
And Mr. Benke, were there dumpsters out during the youth deer hunt or the early antlers hunt this past weekend?
Mr. Chair and members, the dumpster program is the DNR function. And so I know that some of the facilities received remains from outside of the, that kind of dumpster program and checking in with them. But you'll have to ask Dr. Straka or our folks there if they had those actual dumpsters out.
Dr. Straka.
Yep, I can follow up on that one too for you. One thing I do want to, I will follow up on that, Representative. Lee's question really quick about the website and in terms of finding the CWD positive detections and when they were found. I did just get onto the website again through that link that was on the slide I showed you. And you can, there's an option to choose previous year sampling results, Representative Lee, and go back. It looks like you can go back several years and you can see when positives were identified. If you have any issues with that, again, let me know and I'm happy to follow up with you. And we can get you that information, but I will have someone look into the dumpsters and share that information as well to make sure that they were out there during the youth season this previous weekend.
And I would like to ask Commissioner Meyer a policy question if he's available.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So Commissioner Meyer, with the emergency rule that went into effect, have you found any deer that have been moving interstate? Have you intercepted any deer that have been moving in violation of the emergency rule?
Mr. Chairman, to date, we are not aware of any violations to that temporary movement order. So not that we have been notified of.
And if you could just introduce yourself for the record, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources.
And the emergency rule is in effect for an indeterminate amount of time?
Mr. Chairman, the Bob Meyer again, the maximum length of an emergency temporary rule is 18 months. So that's what we've dated the rule till. Because we do not know how long it's going to take to get all the trace outs from those animals completed, we are in contact with Wisconsin USDA, trying to figure out how long that will take, how to expedite that work, And if there is any role for Minnesota to partake in that as well, to deal with the situation that we're in right now.
Anything further you would like to share, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, no, and we will provide you more detailed information, but if you do go to our website and under our CWD management page, you can click on the zone that you're hunting. There are a number of spots that have been open since archery season, not all of them, but if you go by zone, and we'll send that in the information with Dr. Straka follow-up, but there have been collection sites available, not the full force that we'll have open come November 4th, or November 6th, I should say, the opening of the rifle season. But we are doing all we can to provide testing opportunities for people throughout the state.
So you can assure us the DNR is prepared for the season?
Mr. Chairman, fully, and so much that we're well ahead of where we were last year. Last year, though, we know we received the number of samples to statistically meet our needs, but we are full force staff-wise. It'll be hundreds of DNR people, hundreds of other students working with us. It's much like our Division of Forestry's response to fire. The Division of Fish and Wildlife's response to CWD testing is all hands on deck. And I would just like to take this opportunity to thank everyone who is working with us and everybody who will be participating in the CWD sampling this year, because it is very important, as we all know.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we have Commissioner Meyer here, I was just curious, maybe I missed it, but I was wondering, did you have any cost estimates on the trace out?
Mr. Chairman,
Commissioner Meyer.
Representative Heintzman, no, but we will provide that information once it's completed. Obviously, most of that work will be done by Wisconsin USDA and other states, but there will be costs for us as well, as there are in other work that trace outs at the board has done as well. So it's not just a cost from the department. There are other costs to the Board of Animal Health that they have incurred in the past on these types of activities.
Representative Heintzman, any follow-up?
No follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we'll move on. Thank you, DNR and staff. To Dr. Beth Thompson, Board of Animal Health, Dr. Linda Glazer, Board of Animal Health, estimating about 5-minute presentation and 10 to 15 minutes of questions. Dr. Thompson, do you want to go first and introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Beth Thompson, State Veterinarian and Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health. I guess I need a little more coffee on board this morning. I am going to be very, very brief, members. Mr. Chair, I just want to bring to everybody's attention the handout that was provided to members today, and I believe it's up on the website now. I need to contrast that handout that was provided for today's hearing with the one that was provided for the last hearing. So in September, the data that we gave to all of you is that we have 257 cervid herds across the state. And if you remember or have that handout available, we also talked about the state fiscal year testing, CWD testing that had gone on. You have to contrast that with the data that we handed to you today. We have 248 herds, and that was as of the time the data was pulled. But the quarterly or the CWD testing that was provided in that handout for today is a different time period. That is only quarterly testing. So you're going to see a difference in the amount of testing that's gone on. As we continue to move forward, Mr. Chair, I would really appreciate any feedback that you or the other members have in the information that we're giving to all of you in those handouts. We'd like to get that information to you so you have that walking around piece of paper if you need it for anything, and we can get it to you in front of the hearing so you have that. And then to the question about MinPro, I am going to turn it over to Dr. Linda Glazer. She is the program director, and she will be answering that question and any others on the program. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Dr. Glazer, to Representative Morrison's question, and then we'll go to Representative Eklund after Morrison's questions.
Mr. Chair, Beth Thompson again. I do believe that Dr. Glazer does have additional information in a presentation. Thank you.
Yeah, Yep, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Hansen and member of the committee, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Linda Glazer. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Animal Health and oversee the Farm Servant Program. And I hope you can, I'm sharing my screen now and the updates that Dr. Thompson gave. Can you see my screen currently?
No, we see your name, but I don't see your screen. Oh, now I see a screen.
Okay. And it's okay. I think something happened there. All right. And so this was just these are just the items that are in the program update on this slide and that Dr. Thompson went through. I wanted to just briefly talk about our concurrent authority and the steps we're taking toward that as well. Dr. Straka mentioned that we are working on getting a dedicated database for farm servant white-tailed deer so the board and DNR can both access that database, and we would migrate that information, the current information from our database, which includes all livestock animal health information, and we'd migrate the farm servant white-tailed deer data to that standalone system and then share that access and enter information in that from both sides, from both agencies. And we're hoping that is operational by the end of November. And also Dr. Straka mentioned that the DNR is participating in farmed white-tailed deer inspections as well as compliance activity, and that's been occurring since August, and that they're expanding the number of field staff that are participating. They'll be distributed around the state so they can accompany and participate in those activities more readily, closer to the locations where they could be occurring. We have gone to weekly meetings between the Farm Servant Program managers and the DNR project planners. And there's a lot of activity at this time of year in the Farm Servant Program, and there's a lot of information that we need to transmit to the project managers and to the DNR to learn all the aspects of the Farm Servant Program. So we are meeting weekly with them to go over the activities as well as providing them the meeting notes regarding farmed white-tailed deer herds from our weekly Board of Animal Health program staff meeting that we have. And that's been something we've had historically to go over all the issues with the office staff. And so we relay that information to the project planners for the DNR as well, and then have other meetings as needed to discuss specific issues for concurrent authority, including information regarding escapes and trace investigations. And we're planning a Board of Animal Health USDA workshop coming up and outlining some of the DNR participation for that workshop. And then just briefly, I wanted to go through what'll be coming up at the end of the year here is, and the board is CWD endemic area. And as outlined in our Minnesota rule, the hunting season identifies CWD infection in the wild white-tailed deer, the board needs to respond by establishing a CWD endemic area as outlined in the rule, and that's for the purposes of additional movement restrictions put on any farm servant herds that are found in that area. So every time a CWD, a positive white-tailed deer is found, we establish a boundary of 15 miles around that confirmed case where that animal was harvested. And then any farm servant herds in that area are subject to additional movement restrictions. And for the concern of the CWD being found in the wild in that area, moving inside the fence. And so at the end of this hunting season, we'll be evaluating where the CWD positives were found in the free-ranging deer. And typically every year since 2016, that area has expanded and it's encompassed more and more farm servant herds. So if that continues to hold true this year and we see expansion and our boundary will expand and take in additional farm servant herds, and they will be restricted in their movements. And that includes no movements to other locations in Minnesota except to inspected slaughter, no movement of their live servants into that area unless to inspected slaughter. And then the carcasses may not be moved from that area either, with the exceptions of cut and wrapped meat or other parts cleaned to spinal cord and brain tissue allowed to be moved. And as you know, there are exceptions in the rule to those movement restrictions if commingling is prevented between farmed and wild servants. And given our concerns with the most recent CWD infected herds we've identified, we wanted to remove those exceptions through good cause exempt rulemaking this past late spring, early summer. And as you're aware, the judge denied that change to our rules, and that's planned for rulemaking going forward. But anyway, just to give you a brief overview of what will be happening with our CWD endemic area with the end of the hunting season this fall. And that's all the update I had for you today. And so thank you, members of the committee.
I'd like to go back to Representative Morrison to just make sure her question was answered and if she had a follow-up. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I missed it. But yes, I would love to hear what Board of Animal Health is, how they're working with Peter Larson and his group at the U.
Right. I apologize for that. So we have actually Dr. Thompson's suggestion. We have established every other weekly meetings with MinPro staff between the board and the DNR. So we routinely will meet. That's Dr. Michelle Carstensen, myself, and then three members of the MinPro Pro group, Dr. Tiffany Wolf, Mark Schwabenlander, Dr. Peter Larson. We go through, you know, findings and updates from each of our groups. And also we are working with MinPro staff. They have collected tissues from carcasses from us from this most recent Beltrami County herd. And they are doing they did RT quick testing on those carcasses. And they are also working with the landowner, Beltrami County infected herd, that enclosure area, and they're going to be doing some environmental sampling in that enclosure as well. So we've had, we also work with them to inform them of, we've been working with them for over a year to inform them of herds that are going to be, that have, we found CWD infection and they need to be put down. And then they work with USDA to coordinate the sampling of those animals so they can collect tissues for their research projects that they have as well. And then I had the opportunity when I was up for the public meetings in September that the DNR organized to be out on site with the MinPro team that was doing some sampling of that dump site that had been fenced by the DNR. So I could learn more about their sampling procedures and some of the work they're doing on that site. So that was really, I was fortunate to be able to do that as well. So that's some of the things we're working on together.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, and I'm just wondering if the concurrent authority is creating redundancy that makes the use work more cumbersome or complicated. How is it working to have them reporting to both agencies, I guess, is a question that I have. I'm not sure either of you can answer, but if you could, I'd love to hear.
Dr. Thompson?
Well,
or Dr. Glazer?
Yes, Chair Hansen, Representative Morrison. I don't see it as a redundancy. There are many things, that both our agencies are both overseeing farmed white-tailed deer, but there's many other things related to farm servants and wild white-tailed deer that encompasses all of the CWD concerns for both our agencies. And there's not, we all have those issues are not what we're managing, together. So although we're managing the farmed white-tailed deer concurrently, there's many other components of CWD that it's useful for us to exchange information on.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Glazer. I noticed that there's lots of communication going on, it appears, between the Board of Animal Health and the DNR on this, and I appreciate that. This isn't the format that the original legislation had that we had intended, but be that as may, that's how we have to work. So my question is about communication, and you heard mention from Commissioner Meyer about the trace outs, and Representative Heinzman asking about the cost of the trace outs from that movement from these positive COVD farm in Wisconsin into Minnesota. So my question is, how long did it take before the Board of Animal Health communicated with the Department of Natural Resources that they knew that these animals had been transported into the state of Minnesota?
Dr. Glazer?
Chair Hansen and Representative Eklund, I don't have an exact timeline for you. The investigations were received from the state of Wisconsin to the board, and we completed, you know, the identification of where those animals were located and quarantined at the one necessary herd on the same day. We did not communicate that day with it. We had been working with the DNR on all other aspects and hadn't, you know, started working on working with them on investigations at that point. So that was an oversight on the Board of Animal Health's part. And, then when the information came to the, public, with the publication of the article in the Milwaukee Journal, I think it was, we, did relay that information to the DNR, and they're certainly welcome to any of that information. Currently, they are not participating in any of those investigations. We thought that they just weren't ready to take on that component of the program with all the learning of the other parts of it that they were doing.
Representative Eklund.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Glazer, thank you for that answer. But I think if we're going to have concurrent authority or co-authority or co-management or whatever we're talking about, these type of things should certainly be communicated immediately, because now we're in a trace out period that we don't know how much movement we are going to have potentially had between animals. So I applaud you the presentation that you had, but I think there's certainly room for better and more communication between the two agencies. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jordan.
And Chair Hansen and committee members of the committee, Chair Hansen and members of the committee, we have completed all the traces that we have received from the Wisconsin herd, and they were completed in August. We have not received any other traces, and we have not received any other traces from any other states related to that herd to this point.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both the DNR and Board of Animal Health for being here and answering our questions today. I'm glad that it appears that the DNR and Board of Animal Health are talking to each other, but I'm wondering about what other units of government both the DNR and Board of Animal Health are talking to. I've heard specifically from tribal nations at the state government tribal relations training this week that they're not getting adequate communication, especially from Board of Animal Health. So I'm wondering if the Board of Animal Health and the DNR can communicate on how they're talking to other units of government and explaining to everyone in the state of Minnesota about CWD and what hunters need to do to access this, because it's great that we're having this committee. I don't know how many hunters in my district are watching this committee to learn about where they can drop off ahead.
Dr. Thompson, and then on intertribal relations, communication and consultation, and then we'll go back to Commissioner Meyer too, since Representative Jordan asked both agencies. Dr. Thompson.
Yeah. Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, thank you for that question. So immediately post Wisconsin trace that Dr. Glazer has been talking about here, we did put together what we're calling kind of a newsletter. More than anything, it's a weekly summary of some of the work that the Board of Animal Health has done through the week. We're pushing that out to DNR, and I will have to check, Representative Jordan. I thought that was also going out to members of the tribes and tribal groups, so I will double check that. But thank you for bringing that to my attention. I will follow up on that.
And Commissioner Meyer, since the question was to both agencies.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. We communicate very closely with all the tribal nations on a myriad of natural resource issues. We've had leadership to leadership consultations this year with all the tribes, and this issue has come up. We've talked about it with their wildlife managers very closely, especially in the Beltrami area with Leech, White Earth, Red Lake Nations, also Boys Fort, Grand Portage. So our wildlife professionals between the state and the tribal nations communicate weekly, if not daily, most times about natural resource issues, and certainly CWD is amongst those topics.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to both Commissioner Meyer and Dr. Goizer for that answer. I'd like to see more of this. I've had the opportunity to talk to someone from each of our Ojibwe tribes and bands here in Minnesota, and all of them are very concerned about CWD and impacts that it has for their membership, who often rely on venison for protein. I also had an announcement from White Earth to just let people know that they're also collecting deer heads for CWD sampling. And if you drop off a head with them, they will give you a free box of lead-free ammo. And I know that tribal members will also be entered into a drawing for every head that they submit that I think might be a rifle. So it's worth looking into if you are an enrolled member of White Earth. So thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks to everyone.
Thank you. Representative Becker Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Wondering in the discussion about, declaring different counties endemic, is there, could you declare a state endemic and use that as a way to sort of ramp up protections? You know, I know when you look at those maps of how bad it is in Wisconsin, for example, just wondering what our options might be with that, because obviously the live animals are of greatest concern, but there's a lot of other, knowing what we know about prions, there's a lot of other things that maybe we should be looking at to better protect our state from the states that are managed really poorly when it comes to CWD, whether that's hunter harvested deer or, pay to shoot situation or farming. So just wondering, if we've considered avenues to do that to sort of ramp up protections from places like Wisconsin.
Dr. Glazer or Dr. Thompson.
Yes, Chair Hansen and member and Representative Becker Finn. We do, the word endemic is probably not the best term we have for describing what we're doing here, but it is the term that are currently in our rules. We're hoping to change it, but we do have the ability to say when there's CWD and to restrict our imports based on how we interpret whatever information is coming from other states or whatever information is available in other states. So in other words, we say if CWD is endemic in the wild in certain counties in other states in the country, we do not permit imports of farm servants from those areas. And we were just entering into a working group with the DNR looking at revising or reviewing our import requirements for farmed white-tailed deer when the movement stop order was put on by the DNR. So that group is on pause. But so we do look at that, what the data comes from other states. Now, they may not term it endemic, by their own definitions or whatever, but we do have the ability to restrict that import based on what we assess is going on in those other states. And we typically do it on a county by county basis.
Representative Becker Finn.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, just thinking of all the ways that we can better protect our state, just thinking about, other agricultural equipment and products and things like that, that are coming from those places and wanting to make sure that we aren't missing anything. It's a multi-pronged approach that we need to deal with this disease. And just want to make sure we're thinking about that. And I don't know if we have anybody else broader on from ag, but also wondering about the communication that's happening with butchers and meat processors. And in particular, I know that there were some changes in the last session allowing more folks to do it, sort of out out of their garage situation, and just wondering, and I, again, Mr. Chair, I don't know if we've got anybody on that can answer this question today, but I think it's important that folks are thinking about that, and make sure we're not unnecessarily contaminating things and spreading things. So that was my last question, Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure if we have any anyone else on from Ag. I don't know, Dr. Thompson, if you have any ability to speak on that. Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Becker-Finn, I do not, but I can certainly round up with our Department of Ag contacts. Thank you.
If we get some information, we'll post it on the website as well.
Chair Hansen.
Go ahead, Dr. Lather.
Representative Becker-Finn, if I could just be clear, the board has the authority to restrict the imports of live farm servants and carcasses from those farm servants, right? We do not have the authority to restrict equipment or agricultural products or the other things that Representative Becker-Finn was mentioning.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn.
Yeah, and I realize that, but I think that obviously the board has a closer working relationship with the Department of Ag and our, you know, that side of things. So that's why I wanted to make sure I'm bringing that up and that we're thinking about those things. Thanks.
And on that point, Dr. Glazer, do you have the ability to restrict urine or semen moving across state lines?
We don't have the ability to restrict those products, Chair Hansen.
I was asking Representative Heinzman or if any of your members have any questions.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. At the moment, I don't have any questions coming in from my members.
Representative Heinzman, I'd like to work with you and your members on trying to find a way of, I think we're several years into this and the sampling, we're still outsourcing the sampling results. And the money we've invested into the University of Minnesota, you know, they have RT Quick now, if that could be moved from the research side, if it's been validated or at least an attempt to be validated, to move that into a production side, for example, with the veterinary diagnostic lab. And how do we move into production? You know, and I think maybe in a future meeting we'll have Dr. Peter Larson back and maybe university. It seems that both sides of the fence, if we could get the research results into production, obviously it's not this year, but it's in the future, that would seem to be something we would all be interested in. Representative Heinzman.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think that when we have had opportunities to visit with Dr. Larson, it did appear that the timeline for RT Quick to become standardized is still in question, but I think there's also an argument that if there's anything we can do to expedite that, you know, I think that my members certainly are in favor of making sure that due diligence is accomplished in getting through that process. But also, if there's anything holding it up, let's certainly try to move through that and get that done.
Dr. Thompson, is there any discussion with the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab on coordination with MinPro on going into production as this moves out of the research phase?
Mr. Chair, members, that's a very timely question. It's my understanding that Dr. Glazer and folks from DNR do have a meeting this afternoon. And I'm getting a little bit of echo right now, with Dr. Torreson, the director of the Minnesota Diagnostic Lab, to start discussing or pick up that discussion.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just wanted to bring up kind of a follow-up statement or question that Representative Jordan asked. regarding the board, I think it was Dr. Thompson responded when we asked what our tribal communications are. Did I hear you right that the only communications that you're having with our tribal nations are newsletters that are being sent out? I really hope that there's more than just that when we talk about communication with our tribes.
Dr. Thompson.
Yes, Chair Hansen, Representative, thank you for that question. I didn't mean to imply that there is only one newsletter going out. What we did for farm deer and chronic wasting disease specifically is put into place another communication. We have ongoing communications with the tribes and the tribal groups on a number of different levels. And we've had that communication working closely with the United States Department of Agriculture also. So there is somebody also that sits within that federal government agency that we work with ongoing, who is also looped in to all of our communications with the tribes and the tribal groups.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Keeler.
I'd like a little bit more information on what that communication looks like. Like saying communication can be, like you said, like a newsletter, an email. Like I'm really looking for consultation, back and forth communication. Like, can you explain to us who from the tribes, you know, we haven't had anybody in the tribes in these conversations. And so I'm just really trying to figure out here in a public space, how and how often and what ways are you communicating with our tribes? Because like Representative Jordan said, we just sat with many tribal members who are really, really concerned about this, have great ideas, because as you know, we sit on treaty lands. 100% of Minnesota sits on treaty lands, which is to cover our fishing, our gathering, and our hunting. And so it's really concerning to me that we're very vague in how we're communicating with our tribes.
Dr. Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler. So for I'll give one example. For example, the finding of CWD in Beltrami County. Before that information went out to the public, before it went out to any other groups, one communication that was done was to specific people in each of the tribes across Minnesota, not just in the tribes that were located in that area. We utilize the tribal liaison that's located in the Department of Agriculture. Since we're such a small agency, we don't have one of those tribal liaisons. So we work closely with that tribal liaison. And then when DNR and the board came together, we also utilize the DNR liaison from time to time. So that's one specific example, Representative. But if there's additional examples that you'd like me to give, I'd have to do some background information, get back into my calendar and see what information has actually gone out. But that's one specific example.
I would actually like that information because I do think that it's something that we need to work on, especially in this capacity. So I look forward to that information. Thank you.
Representative Jordan, quickly, we're running a little bit slow. So,
yes, Mr. Chair, I have an easy one for the Board of Animal Health. And I'm just wondering if a tribal member has been appointed to the Board of Animal Health and who is it? And if not, what have been the delays and barriers to that? Thank you.
Dr. Thompson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, it is my understanding, I have not been notified that the governor's office has appointed a chair or a person to our Board of Animal Health. I checked probably about 7 to 10 days ago, and that position was still open. Just a reminder to everybody, that position is appointed by the governor's office, but we are waiting for that appointment.
Thank you both, Board of Animal Health and DNR. I would ask formally, you know, that you consider, now that you have joint authority, testing with RT-QIC of all farm cervids as an indicator, and then do a follow-up testing for the necropsy if you have a positive from those results. I'd like you to, there's a meeting this afternoon, I'd like you to consider that. It's my understanding would take about 3 weeks for that to be completed. So I'm formally asking for you to consider that as a way of protecting the deer herd inside and outside the fence. And I did say all cervids, not just white-tailed deer. We'll move on to the DNR and Emerald Ashmore, Amy K. Kerber, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and Emma Schultz, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. We're a little bit behind, but I'm going to try to manage our time and hopefully get a little extra time. So Ms. Kerber and Ms. Schultz, if you could introduce yourself and speak on EAB.
Thank you, Chair and representatives. Are you able to hear me all right?
Yes.
Okay, great, thank you. We'll try to keep this focused and make up a bit of time. I've been in front of this committee before and talked about Emerald Ashmore. To set the context for today's presentation, I'm just going to highlight a few key points about EAB. And then Emma Schultz will talk a little bit about program details and what we've been able to accomplish with the funding so far. So we look at a map of EAB of ASH in Minnesota. You got to get a sense of the big picture. ASH is everywhere in our state. There are nearly 1 billion ASH trees in Minnesota. The map you're looking at illustrates where ASH is located. Those shaded areas represent the density of ASH in our forest. And then the dots represent the percentage of ASH in our communities or cities across the state. We can give this map in more detail. You've all seen it a bunch of times, but you can see distribution here. We've got ASH spread throughout the state. Today, we're focusing on community forests and the grant funding that's been provided for those communities. So to set that context, about 1 in 5 ASH trees in our cities and communities, 1 in 5 trees in our cities and communities is an ASH tree. And that attributes, like you have it all up, about 3 million trees in our parks, yards, or boulevards across the state are ASH. This will, of course, Emerald Ash Borer, which kills all ASH trees, will have impacts to our environment. It will continue to extend climate change issues that we're already seeing. Community ASH trees in Minnesota are estimated to mitigate 8.7 million pounds of atmospheric carbon and have 2.96 billion gallons of stormwater capacity. The reduction of all these ash on our community forests will further widen the gap in our ability to meet greenhouse gas emission goals, and they will increase the amount of salt and sediment that finds its way into an already struggling urban ecosystem. The grants that have been provided so far have been a great way to help slow the spread, support community, and keep community forests healthy. And so we are seeing progress. I'm going to let Emma Schultz take over from here. She'll introduce herself. She's the program lead and knows all of the details of the accomplishments on those grants.
Hi there, Emma Schultz, Community Forest Project Specialist with the DNR. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you so much for the support in recent years. You can check out our DNR's EAB grants handout for more details on the specific projects and types of work that have been completed. But the map that you see here shows all of our grantees from 2019 to present. In 2019, we received funding for 2 grant programs totaling $1 million. Eligible activities included tree removal in 1 grant and tree planting in both grants. 25 grants were offered between the 2 programs. 5 have been completed and the rest are in progress. Those grants run through June of next year. In 2020, we received $1 million in general obligation bond funds allocated to the Shade Tree Program. Eligible activities included tree removal and tree replanting. 17 grants were offered, are in progress, and those grants will run through 2024. In 2021, a combined $1.7 million allowed DNR to offer the Preparing for EAB grant again, with the legal language and eligible activities being the same as that 2019 general fund grant. 26 grants were offered and are in the contract development stage at present. Funding will run through 2023 for that program. Thanks to legislative support, we will be able to offer this same amount again next year, as well as $400,000 in tails in the years following. Lastly, DNR received $3.5 million from LCCMR project funding this year, with $2.4 million of that to be allocated to community grants. The request for applications for this upcoming grant program will be released soon in late November, and projects once funded will run through 2025. All right. So when we look at our accomplishments with legislative funding, we see that our program accomplishments can be broken into several categories based on the activities that we've been able to fund. And across all grants that we've offered since 2019, there will be 9 new community tree inventories and 13 new ash management plans. These first steps are crucial and will allow communities to identify their priorities and address their management issues proactively. There will be a diverse collection of newly planted trees, with over 10,500 new climate adapted trees to be planted through these grant programs. These newly planted trees will remove pollutants from the air, store carbon, and will also help prevent flooding from stormwater runoff. And since 2019, we have been able to fund 56 local units of government, including 53 cities and 3 counties. Our current grants spread across the state from Bemidji to Anoka to Marshall to Albert Lea. And we see that EAB is a statewide issue. And what we've accomplished since 2019 is a great start, but the need remains high given that Minnesota has over 2,600 cities and towns and 87 counties. So looking to the future, we continually hear that communities need resources to support community tree inventories to find out what they have, management plans, especially management plans with an ash and an EAB focus, chemical treatments to preserve healthy, valuable ash, treatment with an injectable insecticide such as amamectin benzoate every 2 to 3 years is an effective way to address EAB. This insecticide is not a neonicotinoid, so the risks to pollinators are minimal when injected properly. These injections kill EAB in the tree, which both slows the spread of EAB and protects the tree. It is a highly effective means to address EAB and spread financial and waste impact, and therefore budgeting out over time. It keeps live ash on the landscape to continue providing the great environmental benefits, such as sequestering carbon and mitigating stormwater runoff. We also hear that communities continue to need ash removals to remove the unhealthy and hazardous ash that they are finding in their communities. Replanting with a wide selection of new trees to diversify the community's canopy, with the goal of making that canopy more resilient to future pests and stressors. And lastly, homeowner assistance. We frequently hear of the need for assistance on private land, which we are currently unable to fund through these programs. DNR works with a network of foresters statewide to lend technical assistance to municipalities, but financial support is needed to help communities respond to this crisis. So looking ahead, we see that community assistance is critical. Despite recent funding, community need remains high. In 2018, DNR used some one-time grant dollars from the U.S. Forest Service to help address EAB in communities. And we received over 100 applications for a total request of $2.4 million. We were only able to fund 4 requests since we only had $109,000 to grant. Since 2019, our 4 state-funded programs, which total $3.7 million in funding, have received $8.46 million in requested funds, meaning we have only been able to award funds to 44% of the applications we've received. Going beyond those that have applied for funds, we have also heard from many municipalities that they didn't apply at all because they're worried about those limited funds. The Environmental Quality Board's EAB report recommends $8.5 million per year in community support statewide. We continue to hear from cities that they need assistance identifying the right tools to address EAB and how to use them, from treatment to removing and replanting new trees, plus how to care for those new trees that they plant and how to help homeowners. To give you a cost comparison, the average cost for treatment of a 20-inch diameter ash ranges from $120 to $240 every 2 to 3 years. compared with the estimated cost for a community to remove a single public ash, which is around $1,000. These costs may be more significant for rural or smaller communities with less infrastructure in place. Compare that to homeowners who may pay between $1,000 to $4,000 for a single ash tree removal, depending on the size and location. Ultimately, if communities do not have the needed financial and technical assistance, they will have a community full of standing dead trees. And if communities are not able to manage their ash, EAB will spread to neighboring communities and to our ash forests, which will have broad environmental ramifications. And I'll turn it back to Amy K. Kerber to wrap up this presentation.
Proceed.
Thank you. Just real brief, you heard a lot of lessons learned there from Emma, conscious of time. I do just want to highlight that the financial assistance that has already been provided to cities has allowed many of them to replace and treat ahead of or quickly after infestation. And this sort of effort is really helping us to keep EAB out of our northern forests and spreading to other nearby communities. So that's something for us to keep in mind. You know, we're facing a pretty big fight. And you've all heard this for many years. We are holding where we're at, which is good. And we all know that we're getting closer to that point in the curve or on the chart where we're going to see accelerated growth. But efforts like this to help keep and treat EAB and communities where it is and get ahead of it are making a big effect. I'll pause there and maybe there are questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Lippert.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I want to thank the DNR for their work here. And just note that I'm in Northfield, and Northfield's one of the communities that's received a grant. Looks like I might be freezing up, but I'll keep talking through. And city officials are very grateful for these funds. We know that emerald ash trees are dying. We need to be able to remove them. And we also have a climate action plan. And so it's critical that we're taking care of our forest and planting trees in order to be able to meet our climate goals. So these funds are very, very important, and officials in Northfield are grateful that they're available.
Ms. Kerber.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Lippert, that's great to hear. And one of the things that we have noted is that city budgets are capped and they're not able to absorb costs to treat and address EAB. One learning that we've had is that by spreading the cost of EAB treatment out over time in increments like this is allowing communities to better address EAB, not only absorb the cost appropriately, but also to make wise decisions about their forest management in their communities.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to our speakers. I had to switch to my phone, so I apologize that my camera is off. But thank you so much for the presentation today. And as was stated, one of the goals with this program is to slow the spread of emerald ash borer to prevent kind of this crisis from happening across our state. And as you demonstrated in the presentation today and with the handouts that you provided, the local government demand far outweighs the current resources that are available to address emerald ash borer. And also, as you stated, that there are multiple benefits that planting trees and maintaining tree canopies does to community health and resiliency, stormwater and all of those carbon. And so it's my understanding that in Washington, D.C., the Congress is considering to allow flexibility in how some of the ARP funds can be spent in states and local governments. And so as a part of that, it's my understanding to be able to address kind of some natural disaster issues, and wondering if there's going to be a push through the DNR or through the administration to try and use some of the funds to help address this unmet need in looking at Emerald Ash Borer in Minnesota.
Maybe Commissioner Meyer, that's a question for you, or I don't know if Ms. Kerber or Ms. Schultz wanted to take that one. Commissioner Meyer?
I was trying to raise my hand electronically, but I couldn't find the button. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner DNR, and thank you, Representative Acuff. This is a very important issue, as we've talked about. The unmet need that we just have from the past two grant rounds is really high, and we are working with the administration for a supplemental budget request on this issue and a couple other pieces as well related to climate change and reforestation. So this is very important, and we're looking forward to presenting something to the legislature as soon as we possibly can.
Representative Acuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, Commissioner Meyer, I would just encourage to consider, not just through the legislative process, but if there's ARP funds, I presume that would be at the discretion of the governor to be able to allocate. And so I would encourage you to request those resources as well.
And maybe I missed it, but what was the exact amount of demand of requests that came in and the amount of money that went out this summer after this bill? Maybe Ms. Kerber, Ms. Schultz, how much in request came in? Dollar amount.
I can take that. Emma Schultz, Community Forest Project Specialist. For the 2021 Preparing for EAB grants, we received 43 applications. The total requested was $2.62 million about. So we were able to fund 26 of those 43.
Thank you. Representative Lippert and Representative Acuff, were you done? Your hands are still up. But...
Yes, I'm done. Sorry.
Okay. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so thank you, Commissioner Meyer, for saying that you are thinking about a supplemental request for the community tree planting. And then I see, you know, Mr. Chair, hopefully you allow me some latitude here. In the capital investment request for DNR, there's a request for $5 million. And so is it the intent of the DNR to put in a supplemental request in the Environment and Natural Resources Finance Committee and carry on with the request and capital investment? Or what is the idea here? And also, how did the 2020 appropriations of the $1 million in the bonding bill what role does it play in the, what is the impact of that $1 million for these communities' requests?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's a lot of questions there, Chairman Lee. I'll try to answer them to the best of my ability. So the $1 million to start with, we're distributing those dollars right now. Our bonding package has different pieces to it, right? There's money there for reforestation of state forest lands. We also have an accelerated piece that we've talked about to move forward dealing with drought initiatives. That's a $13.3 million package that would be general fund that would deal with some more reforestation, and then shade tree EAB grants, $4.5 million there. Our bonding package also contains pieces related to Bedora Nursery as well, as you've been up there. So that's a really important project. But there's a lot of different pieces that fit together under this. And as we move forward, preparing a climate package from the executive branch to present to the legislature, there will be similar things in there with reforestation as well. I think the best thing, Mr. or Chairman Lee, would be for us to prepare a simple one-page document as how it all fits together, right? As Representative Acuff noted, there's ARP funds. There's the governor's pot of ARP funding. There's the money that I believe it's $1.1 billion that the legislature will be participating in the spending of those dollars. There's general fund dollars in a supplemental budget process that are being evaluated and looked at. And then there's bonding dollars as well. So there are a lot of different pots of money that some of them spill over into each other, right? About fungibility, so that it will be a roadmap that we will need to work through together as to what money do we use to fund what, and how does it all work at the end of the day. So an interesting time. We'll submit detailed information how they all fit together to the committee.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up, just to let members of the committee know, I'm referring to the DNR's priority ranking number 10 request of $5 million for community tree planting grants. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to push a little bit over. We've got another presentation, but I want to represent Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we had Commissioner Meyer on again, I just wanted to quick add to the questions. Commissioner Meyer was going through a list of a number of different pots of money. I was wondering if he could recall, I can't, has LCCMR or any legacy dollars ever been tapped, or has there been bills that would have potentially, I think the chair is nodding yes. I'm not recalling if those things were funded. Does anybody have that information?
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Kerber, I think we had LCCMR.
Yeah. In front of Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner DNR, I do not have the actual dollars in front of me on those appropriations, but we'll include that in our response.
Mr. Chair, I can add just
Ms. Kerber, if you can answer that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to get the exact amount because I'm guessing you were wondering, Representative Heintzman, on how much of the LCCMR funding went specifically to grants to communities. But last year in 2021, we received $3.5 million from LCCMR funding for EAB. And just let me look at that. $2.4 million of that is allocated to community grants.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to quick mention or quick ask that question. I thought that LCCMR money had been used, but just after hearing the list, I was concerned maybe that I had missed it. So that one pager from the commissioner would probably be pretty helpful as we're going forward to make sure that we're looking to as many opportunities to help community issues with Emerald Ash Borer. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'd also appropriated some in 2019, FY 2019 from LCCMR. I think the mix that we had here is we wanted to get some of this into the base so there'd be ongoing money. And I think Ms. Schultz and Ms. Kerber had mentioned that. So there's some money ongoing, not as much as we had hoped, but there's a lot of one-time money that's there. And I think that's what Representative Akam was alluding to, is the DNR has a request for a lot of tree reforestation. I think Representative Lippert talking about climate as well, that was presented as a special session. And if there, you know, are changes in congressional action to change authority to allow for climate and disaster use of ARP funds, whether it's a direct executive or joint, I think that would be appropriate and timely. Since we have the demand, we can get some more trees planted. And Representative Heintzman, I'd like to work with you on that. If there's anything we can do to try to get more trees planted in this next year, I think it would be a good use. So Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And part of the reason that I wanted to highlight the LCCMR or the legacy dollars that were spent in this subject area category is I think that most Minnesotans expect the money that has been promised to the outdoors for restorations and for preservation, so on and so forth, to have an impact in this area. And communities are obviously facing a crisis where Emerald Ash Borer has taken many, many hundreds, if not more, trees out of their area. So that was something that I know that folks in general are bringing up when this subject is brought forward. It would maybe be nice to have an ongoing appropriation, but I think that we have plenty of dollars available in the funds that that are specifically been tailored to work with environment natural resource issues. And this, I think, falls into that category very closely. So it could be ongoing dollars as the need is there. And hopefully that can be a useful tool to combat this problem. That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And if there's some federal one-time money that's applicable, maybe we could do a joint letter, Representative Heintzeman.
I think we could work something out. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Gerber, Ms. Schultz, and Commissioner Meyer. We are now going to switch to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Katrina Kessler on update on local government water infrastructure grants. And I've been told we have an absolute hard stop at 11:44. So proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just confirming that you can hear me and you can see my screen. Okay.
That is correct. Yep.
Great. So thank you to the chair and to the committee for this brief opportunity to provide a high level overview of our ongoing work to develop the local government water infrastructure grants. So the need to assess and develop plans to adapt stormwater and wastewater infrastructure to extreme weather is not unique, unfortunately, to one part of our state. Impacts are visible across the state from flooded streets, homes, businesses, and sewer overflows. And what we at the MPCA regularly hear in our conversations with local partners is that planning work is a barrier to unlocking the public facility authority monies and bonding funds to implement adaptation practices that are needed at the local level where they are really bearing the brunt of the climate change impacts. And data are showing that we are already experiencing more intense storm events, and you all know this. And as a result, we are seeing our already aging and overburdened infrastructure experience extra stress. To drive home this point, I'll just note that Minnesota now averages more than 200 releases of untreated or partially treated wastewater every year, and 75% of these are related to wet weather, rapid snowmelt, or heavy rain events. So as I mentioned, the need for and the request for assistance spans the entire state. Local partners have articulated those needs in conversations with the agencies, in response to infrastructure needs surveys, and in support of the resilience planning grant proposal last spring through the legislative session. More than 70% of the need is in greater Minnesota, but not shown on the map is that the Met Council, which also requires all of their communities to develop local water plans and consider future needs, including adaptation needs, also within the metro area needs are great. So it's everywhere. I will just call out, these are the facility or these are the locations in greater Minnesota, not shown on the map, is the metro area where there is also a significant need. And work to assess vulnerabilities, to do the planning and to prioritize projects is not covered by current PFA and bonding funds. So the planning grant for stormwater, wastewater, and community resilience will provide almost $2 million to our local partners and tribes across the state for the planning work and assessment of climate risks over the next 2 years. This is really needed at this moment in time, as the discussion has just been highlighted. We are on the cusp of hopefully unlocking a lot of federal funds and being able to leverage the planning that is needed at the local level to bring additional efficiency to those dollars if and when they are delivered to the state. And regardless, this planning and engineering review is necessary to get prepared to ask for bonding dollars and to effectively implement our existing PFA dollars. So there are several areas on the slide that are highlighted. I will just briefly say that we know there are needs, significant needs related to stormwater, water storage in the urban area, slowing runoff down, assessing the condition of pipes and treatment, as well as on the wastewater side, which unfortunately, when you have leaky pipes, excess stormwater makes its way into wastewater pipes, conveyances, and then the facilities, and that's when you get the overflows. And we also recognize that there's just a general need across the state for communities to assess vulnerabilities and bring resilience to infrastructure beyond water, which could begin to be covered by this proposal. So really quickly, we expect that the RFP for the grants will be available shortly. We're hoping that it will go out at the beginning of November, and then communities and partners will have an opportunity to apply for the grants through the end of the year. And we expect and hope to award the grants in March of next year, and then projects would have to be completed before the end of the following June. So, the The slide calls out greater Minnesota communities, but I will say that we are also looking in the metro area at needs that do exist, and that we are prioritizing equity as one of the lenses by which we will evaluate the proposals. And because we know that the biggest gap currently in state assistance and federal assistance exists in the stormwater realm, we're looking at stormwater projects as ranking fairly high in this initial round of this, although it will be determined what type of projects people submit. But we know that we've heard from partners and through others that this is a big need. So that is all I have, Mr. Chair, and happy to answer questions that members may have.
We have 4 minutes. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And similar to the question for the DNR, Commissioner Kessler, so how does this water infrastructure assistance grants program tie into the stormwater infrastructure grants that you have as your number one request in the funding committee?
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lee, thank you for that excellent question, because it really is the foundational work that is necessary in order for the bonding dollars to be utilized to the most effective possible means. So this is the planning phase, and then the bonding dollars will fund the implementation of projects and actions. And I will say that through our work, we know that communities are at different ends of the spectrum, that some communities have yet to begin the planning and the assessment of climate vulnerabilities. And there are communities that are, of course, further along. And planning dollars will be able to help people wherever they are in their journey, and implementation dollars will be able to help people who are ready to take the actions called for in their plans to get at their highest priority.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, so how does the federal infrastructure bill, knowing that they're still, you know, having negotiations at the federal level, play into the request that you have for capital investment, and how does that impact the planning grants here? Is it going to supplement this, or what role does the federal bill play if there is, you know, final passage soon or not?
Ms. Kessler.
Chair Hansen and Representative Lee, another excellent question. And we have been watching the negotiations at the federal level very closely. I will say that I think the planning that has been described today will be critical, regardless of what source becomes available for implementation. We have heard that if the federal infrastructure package passes as it has been described recently, there will be opportunities for communities to receive monies to do some planning. So similar to what this resilience grants will do, we think that work will also be able to be funded by federal infrastructure dollars. We know that $2 million is not enough to do this work. I think we're expecting that we can fund, 15, maybe 20 communities work with the $2 million, and the implementation need is vast. I would say $1 billion plus. And so the money that we're asking for on the bonding side will begin to help communities get in line and prioritize. And then if we get a lot of federal money, we can think about what else we can do, because I think there will be some flexibility with the federal dollars. And there are many, many climate needs beyond just stormwater infrastructure that I think we would love to be able to work on.
We would like to work with you on emphasizing things that can be not done now to impact climate. If there's one-time federal money, we would obviously, the more that can be done, the faster it can be done, and the most effectively way it can be done, we'd be happy to help. And so this relates to not only these grants, but any other grants. The legislature isn't in session until January 31st. I anticipate we will have another hearing or two, just kind of looking back and looking at the present and looking forward. So thank you all for your efforts, and have a good weekend. We are adjourned.